Веселый шумою толпою цыгане табором бегут. Всегда гитара под полою, всегда играют и поют. Вьется песня, бабочка звонко, и все полночи лихой напев. Цыган играет, поет цыганка, и вторят и все таборный припев.
That was the semi-drunken comedic dancing of former Russian President Boris Yeltsin, everybody. Let's give him a hand!
At Uncle Elroy's house, which Elroy, of course, as some of you know, in French Spanish means the king. So that is what we call him. On the king's porch that night, well, he delivered to us news of a most incredible dream he had had. He said that the evening prior, as he slept, he had conjured in his mind thoughts of a bacchanal party, which was unlike any ever attended before. This bacchanal party was all about rich, creamy potato salad. About sitting in that potato salad. About sleeping in that potato salad. About wading through rooms filled to the brim with that good-tasting, down-home potato salad. Cavorting in potato salad. It was the greatest festival of its kind he had ever attended, he said, well, in dreamland. And he had been to quite a few. So I told him we should make this dream come true. Have this engagement for real and invite all of the townsfolk. Oh, he said this sounded quite unreasonable, for he would then have to fill his home all the way up with good taste and lovable potato salad. In the end, well, he agreed. So that's what we did. But surprisingly, the guests did not enjoy themselves as much as in his vision. No, many of them found wading through all of that mayonnaise quite disgusting. Most wanted slaw, corn fritters, a leg of chicken, or devil's eggs with their potato salad. But we didn't have any, for this was a potato salad bacchanal. Some even requested succotash. But I met an interesting friend there. A worldly, exotic woman. Who I had never seen in town before. And that is because she was one of those rare tourists that up until that time in our county they had only spoke of in lore. I wrote a little poem about her, and I'd like to read it to you tonight. It's called The Geriatric Mule by Henry Gibson. You were an elegant woman, aged, oh, about 199. In the corner at the king's party, talking to all of the guests so gladly. Though they were complaining about the goo in their shoes, you just wanted to tell your story. And I was happy to be there to listen. To Egypt you had been, and Canada too. Blue and yellow emeralds you wore, and a magical horseshoe diamond. Had seen alligators and frogs of swamps all over the world. But you liked it best in Budapest and Haiti, you said. where the people are hungry and they bleed from the eyes. It is here that the geriatric lady is known as the Mule, and they gave her riches galore for her tasty brown sugar, which showed in her stomach or hid in her purse, turned her inside out like a gutted polecat to get to those riches. The people loved that stuff so much, she said, that they would often ingest it in interesting ways rather than chew. They sure did love her brown sugar, and I know that that's true, because she also told me that the party was fine, if you like potato salad, which was hard to deny. So I thank you, Geriatric Mule, for your happiness and truth, but most of all, for being a bright spot in an otherwise dark evening.
I thought it was a lovely act. It didn't challenge me in any way. And it only tickled my funny bone gently, allowing me to avoid potential sprains and, of course, severe morning aches.
Thank you very much. You are so very kind. People, let me tell you something. You know, there is a moment in every magic act, in every piece of good entertainment, that I wish every other moment in life could mirror. It is something sort of like hope or expectation. I don't know what it is. It's not the magical act itself. It's that second during the vanishing, or that moment of mystery where you wonder what's about to happen, or what's become of your hero, or what's become of that object. It is floating in the air in front of you, but it has great weight. It's a moment minus understanding, yet it's so beautiful, yes.
Whoa! That was amazing! How did you do that, Timmy?
It's some magic!
How did you get all those parakeets in your mouth? Whoa! Outstanding. And we're talking the whole time. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Danny.
In every single can of good-tasting owl poo. Buy it for your best friend. And I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
That was the ghost of Lauren Green with the preceding commercial announcement. Thank you so much for being here, Mr. Green.
Why, you're welcome. You know, in all of my years of entertaining in my past life, I always enjoyed the variety shows the most. They say it's the spice of life. And I've been in great shows and films, so I should know. Shows like Bonanza and Battlestar Galactica. Movies like Peyton Place and Vasectomy.
Wow, how nice. Vasectomy. I'll have to see that one, sir.
Yes, you should indeed.
Ooh, let's laugh.
The ghost of Lauren Green, everyone.
I'll do my best, he said, but sometimes I fear the dice are loaded against me. They were loaded indeed, and more heavily than either of us dreamed. The rest of his tragic history is soon told. In the 80s and 90s, Sir Henry Thompson, the famous doctor, used to give octave dinners, as he called them, from the number of guests. He was a good doctor, I believe, and knew a great deal about stricture and the prostate gland, but he was proud of the fact that he had written two dull novels and had paintings hung in the Academy exhibitions. He loved to show two or three pictures of Alma Tadema in his drawing room, which in itself defines his taste and prescribes his talent. He was kindly, however, and at 70, kindliness is a proof of virtue. His wines, too, were sound without being extraordinary, and his guests were often interesting. At one such dinner, I remember Randolph was a guest of honor and sat at our host's right. Lord Moore sat on Thompson's left, and I came next. And on my left was Sir Richard Holmes, the genial librarian of Windsor. He was kind enough to ask me to come down and pay him a visit and inspect the collection, and I would have accepted eagerly had he not first talked to me of his watercolor sketches, which also could be seen from time to time gracing the anemic walls of the Academy. The amateur artist, like the amateur writer, is to me almost as boring as the actor or singer. When we sat down at table, I was opposite Randolph and could not but notice that he bowed very glumly to Lord Morris, who was on my right, and still more coldly to me. He looked far worse now than when I had seen him in Grosvenor Street only a couple months before. His face drawn and his skin leaden gray, there were gleams of hate, anger and fear in his eyes, the dreadful fear of those who have learned how close madness is. The soup had come and gone when I said something about Ireland to Lord Morris, who agreed with me. To my amazement, Randolph suddenly broke in angrily. "You know a great deal about Europe, Mr. Harris, and of course all there is to be known about America," he barked at me. "But what do you know of Ireland?" "I was born in Galway," I replied, "and brought up in the royal school at Armagh, and one gets from childhood a certain flair difficult to acquire in later years." "Impossible to acquire," chimed in Lord Morris. "No Saxon ever gets it. I knew without asking you that you were a native of my dear, distressful country." Lord Morris spoke with a brogue that would bear, but he always showed me a great deal of kindness, perhaps because I learned very early in our acquaintance that he had a foot in both the Irish camps, and was one of the very few men whose opinion on Irish matters could be accepted without misgiving. I believe that he was only scored off once in his life, and that was by the notorious Father Healy, a great friend of his. One day Lord Morris was describing a wedding he had witnessed, and carried away by the beauty of the bride, he added, "And there was I, with not even a slipper to throw at her." "Why on earth didn't you throw your brogue?" whipped in Healy, brogue being also the name given to the Irish peasant's stout shoe. All through the next course, Lord Randolph didn't speak a word. As the game was being taken round, the footman noticed that it was not properly cut, so he passed Lord Randolph quickly to get it dispieced at the sideboard. At once Randolph, pointing with an outstretched hand, squealed out as if in pain, "Eee!" "What is it, Lord Randolph?" asked the host in utter solicitude. "Eee!" he repeated the high squeal while pointing his finger after the footman. "I want eee! Some of eee!" "It shall be brought back," said Sir Henry. "I'm glad you like it." The grouse was brought back. Randolph helped himself and began to eat greedily. Suddenly he stopped, put down his knife and fork, and glared at each face round the table, apparently suspecting that his strange behavior had been remarked. He was insane, that was clear. From that moment on, I could drink, but not eat. Randolph Churchill mad, like Marsupin. When the table broke up, I asked Holmes had he noticed the incident with the game. "No, I didn't remark anything, but the grouse was excellent," he said. Later, I asked Lord Morris had he remarked anything strange in Randolph's behavior. "No," he replied, "except that he seems to be in a damn bad temper." "Didn't you notice how he squealed and pointed?" I went on. "He's mad." "Was he ever sane?" countered Morris, laughing, and therewith I had to be content. But ever afterwards I knew I had seen Randolph Churchill in what I called the malignant monkey stage of insanity. His shrill, prolonged squeal is always in my ears when I think of him. Years later, after he returned to London and died there, I happened to be at dinner once, and beside Mrs. Jack Leslie, his wife's sister, I told her of my experience at Sir Henry Thompson's Octave. "Randolph was quite mad," she said, "when my sister took him on that last trip round the world. We all knew it. No one but Jenny would have trusted herself to go with him, but she's afraid of nothing and very strong. Why, once, she told me, he drew out a revolver in the cabin and threatened her, but she snatched it from him at once, pushed him back against the berth, and left the cabin, locking the door behind her. Jenny is the bravest woman I ever knew." No wonder Winston has proved his courage time and again. One day, some years later, I was at dinner with Lady Randolph, as I always called her, at Lady Cunard's. I told her something of what Mrs. Jack Leslie had told me, and expressed my admiration of her courage in taking Randolph around the world. At first, she said, when he was practically a maniac, and very strong, it was bad enough. But as soon as he became weak and idiotic, I didn't mind. What an epitaph.
Thank you, Mr. McKellen. Sir Ian McKellen, reading from the works of Frank Harris.
I'm in the hallway, you guys. Could somebody get out here? I seem to have caught my leg in something.
Caught in what, Dan?
I can't tell. It looks like a trap for squirrels, maybe, or some rodents.
Why would somebody put a squirrel or rodent trap in the hallway?
Squirrels aren't rodents, and I don't know.
I guess there were some rodent troubles in the building a couple of years ago. Thinking about it...
I don't know. I'm not sure about that, guys. It's hard to say. Just please come get me out of the trap.
Well, I can't. I'm busy.
I can come in a couple minutes.
Can't? A couple of minutes? What? Don't you understand? I've got to keep these people entertained.
All right. We'll get out there.
Keeping you waiting, dragging it out, keeping you waiting. Talk real quiet now. Here's your punchline. It's time for the punchline.